Well, today we are going to begin going through our overview of the Bible as this year we journey through God's Word together, hopefully in relatively chronological order. And today we're going to be looking at quite a big chunk of biblical history from creation all the way up through the time of the patriarchs, basically the books of Genesis, and we're going to tuck Job in there as well. And hopefully if you had a chance to follow along with the daily readings for January this last 3 weeks and were able to read over or listen to the books of Genesis and Job, today it's going to be kind of an experiment of how I'm presenting this. There's a few things that I want to try as we go through this, and I'm going to invite your feedback afterwards. You can let me know what things work, what things don't work, anywhere where you think there could be improvements made, what was helpful, what was not helpful, etc. But what I want to try to do is go over in a very general sense the history that is covered in these two books of the Bible today. I want to begin each discussion in this series, though, by giving the 30,000-foot overview, a very brief synopsis of the historical narrative that's covered under the text that we've read and the things that God is accomplishing in that. And with each lesson, I also want us to follow a thread, this continuous story. Why are we being told this information? Why is it important and relevant to us? And what we'll see is the thread is the unfolding of God's plan for his people, for salvation, and ultimately for you and I even today. And then finally, we want to delve just a little bit deeper into some of the more relevant details of the narrative that will, again, hopefully give us some more clarity about what's going on in the history of the Bible and seeing how it all fits together and hopefully maybe even seeing things maybe even a little bit differently than what we have in the past. So buckle up. We're going to go quickly because we got a lot of information to cover this morning. We'll begin with the 30,000-foot overview, flying in a plane, looking down over this. And what's interesting to me is when we consider the books of Genesis and Job, that's about 7% of the biblical narrative as far as volume of words and things like that. And it actually covers, though, the longest period of time that we will cover in any one of our summary lessons. There's a total of 2,369 years of biblical history covered in the books of, really primarily in the book of Genesis. And then we're tucking Job into that narrative as well. And so just for perspective, there's from creation through Revelation, there's only about 4,274 years worth of history that's covered. And so in this first lesson, in the book of Genesis, the very beginning of the Bible, we're covering more than 50% of all biblical history in this one study today. So as we think about the synopsis or the big picture view of Genesis in particular, we see that in the beginning, there is the creation of all the heavens and the earth, including man, who was created to be in a loving relationship with his creator, with God. And initially, when God created everything, all was good. Everything was perfect. But then enters the problem of sin. And man falls from and really abandons this relationship that he has with God through his commission of sin. And then we see the subsequent promise that God makes that this problem of sin will one day be dealt with and overcome. We see the results of wickedness, that is the idea of selfish pursuits and disregard to God, contrasted with righteousness, walking with God, calling on his name, seeking him. We see those two things illustrated vividly in the accounts of, for example, Cain and Abel, the epic of the flood, and even the chaos at the Tower of Babel. And then, beginning in about chapter 12 of Genesis, we see the gradual unfolding of God's eternal plan for redemption, which will ultimately be fulfilled through the man Jesus Christ, the Son of God on earth. But in Genesis, this unfolding begins with the calling of a man, Abraham, and the formation of a family through his promised son Isaac and his promised son Jacob, and then Jacob's 12 sons. And then the planting of the seeds of a nation, explaining to us how Israel's family ended up down in Egypt, where they would be in a kind of a bubble where they could grow into a nation that God will ultimately call out and make his own. And there's this thread that we want to follow throughout this narrative of history. And really, we see this captured in the book of Genesis quite well. It's the tracing of the line of the seed. There in the beginning, God is going to make a promise that there will be enmity between the seed of Satan and the seed of woman. And that ultimately, Satan will bruise him on the heel, but he will crush Satan on the head. And that's the first messianic promise that talks about the coming of Christ. Christ is the seed. And so we see that line of the seed from Adam to Noah to Abraham to Isaac to Jacob and then to Judah, ultimately. The line of that seed is going to be traced through the book of Genesis. So as we dig a little bit deeper into the narrative and we notice some of the major events and some relevant supplemental information that will hopefully illuminate it for us a little bit better. We begin in 4174 BC. That's the beginning. In the beginning, God created everything, the heavens and the earth. In 6 days, he created everything in the universe, including the earth and all that is on it. And on the seventh day, God rested. That is, he ceased from creating new things. The crowning achievement of his creation on day six was man, male and female. We know them as Adam and Eve. These were beings who were created in the very image of God with eternal souls and free will, designed for the purpose of being in an intimate relationship with God, that they might choose God above all else, so that they might glorify him and honor him with and throughout their entire lives. And after creating this first married couple, God placed them in the Garden of Eden, where they enjoyed a special relationship with God. They were given dominion over all the creation with only one prohibitive rule. Do not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But in Genesis chapter 3, we see what's commonly referred to as the fall of man. We don't know how long man lived in the garden. I would suggest to you that it had to have been within the first 100 to 115 years of his existence. But within a short period of time, relatively speaking, man and woman sinned. They failed to live in their God-given roles, violating the one and only prohibition. They ate from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And as a result, they died spiritually and were that day separated from their relationship with God. And that separation was punctuated by their removal and banishment from the Garden of Eden. And from this point forward, the history of the Bible is really the unfolding of God's eternal plan to rectify the problem of our sin and to bring us, his creation, back into a meaningful, rich, and lasting relationship with him. Once out of the garden, Adam and Eve have at least two sons that we're told about, Cain and Abel. And it's not very long. Again, we don't know how many years after the first sin the events in Genesis chapter 4 occurred. It had to have been sometime prior to Adam's 130th year. So within the first 130 years of creation, Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve's eldest sons, get into a conflict. Truth be told, it was really Cain's problem. He's the one who had the issue. He was jealous of his brother's righteousness. And as a result of his jealousy, he ends up murdering his own brother and is cursed by God to wander as a vagrant on the earth. And from this point forward, at least until the flood, the descendants of Cain, his lineage appears to be characterized by nothing more than rebellion against God and pursuit of selfish desires. Which leads us then to the next major event, which is the flood. We have in Genesis chapter 5, though, a genealogy, a record of descent containing 10 generations from Adam down through Noah. And what's interesting is sometimes as we're reading those things, we don't appreciate how much time is involved here. But the genealogy in Genesis chapter 5 brings us down a century and a half, that is 1,500 years roughly, from the birth of Seth, when Adam was 130 years old, 130 years after creation, down to the 500th year of Noah. And in Genesis chapter 6, we see the abhorrent wickedness of man, contrasted with the righteousness of Noah. The man's wickedness is so bad that God determines, I'm going to wipe man out with a universal flood. And only Noah found favor in the eyes of God. And so God gives Noah some instruction about how he and his family can be spared from the flood. And over the course of about 75 to 100 years, Noah, just as God instructed him, constructed the ark. He gathered supplies and food for himself and for his family. That would include his wife and his three sons and his three sons' wives, so eight people in all. And all the land animals, two male and female pairs of every unclean kind of animal, and seven male and female pairs of every clean kind of animal. And he brought them onto the ark. And in the 600th year of Noah, so 2518 BC, that was 1,656 years after creation, or from our perspective, looking back, only 4,542 years, God sent the flood on the world. And for 40 days and 40 nights, it rained until the highest mountains were covered. The floodwaters prevailed on the earth then for 150 days, extinguishing all life in whose nostrils was the breath of life. Noah and his family, along with all of the animals that were taken on the ark, remained on the ark for 1 year and 17 days until the waters of the flood receded, the land dried up, and God instructed them to disembark from the ark. At this point, God made with Noah and his descendants an everlasting covenant. We think of it as the rainbow covenant. God put his bow in the cloud and promised that never again would he destroy all of the earth with a flood because of the wickedness of man. But now we're starting over, essentially, with the family of Noah. So that leads us to the next major breakdown, and that is the repopulation of the earth. In Genesis chapter 10, we have what sometimes is referred to as the Table of Nations. It's a list of the genealogies or the descendants or really the family trees of Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, from which the whole earth was populated. They were given an instruction from God when they got off the ark, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But man failed to do that. Instead of spreading out over the earth, man sought to consolidate themselves in one place. They built the Tower of Babel as their icon to keep them unified. And it was during these days, the Tower of Babel, that God came down and confused the languages of man so they couldn't communicate with one another, thus forcing them to scatter throughout all of the earth. And that happened, the text tells us, in the days of Peleg, who was born only 101 years after Shem got off the ark. So, we're not exactly sure when the Tower of Babel occurred or the scattering of mankind, but it seems to have been, I would suggest, within the first 100 to 150 years after the flood waters receded. We're then given in Genesis chapter 11 a specific genealogy, this of Noah's middle son, Shem. And the text is Genesis chapter 11, verse 10 through 26. And those short verses cover roughly 350 years. From the birth of Arpachshad, the son of Shem, 2 years after the flood, all the way down to the birth of Abraham in 2166 B.C. It's here at this point that I want us to insert the account of Job. And there's a couple reasons why I think it fits here in our chronology. And those are based upon some things that are mentioned in the text of Job itself. Job is identified as being from the land of Uz in Job chapter 1 and verse 1. Uz, interestingly enough, is the second generation descendant of Shem via Shem's son Aram. There is a land in northwest Mesopotamia called Aram. The Arameans come from there. And there's actually a city in the country of Aram that is called Uz. And some have suggested that this is perhaps the place where Job was from. It's interesting that Job is identified in verse 3 as being the greatest of all the men of the East. And usually when that kind of terminology is used in the biblical narrative, the East is in reference to some land east of, or as you're looking at the map, to the right-hand side of Canaan's land, the Promised Land, indicating perhaps that it was in northern Arabia somewhere, or even east of the Euphrates River, maybe between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. The reality is whether he came from what we know of as Babylon, or Assyria or Aram in the north, the point that I want to make is that that's the general area where Abraham's family came from. And so the fact that we have a non-descendant of Abraham, knowing and being in a relationship with the one true God in that part of the world, especially at this point in time, only a few generations removed from Noah coming off the ark, shouldn't trouble us at all. But to me, the clincher of why I think Job fits here is because of what's told us at the end of his story. That after the events of the book of Job occurred, it says that he lived for another 140 years. Now, we're not told how old Job was at the beginning of the story, but he has 7 sons and 3 daughters who are all adults, and so I would suggest to you that he has to be at least in his mid-50s when the events began to occur. He could have been older than that. So if you take just 50s, the mid-50s, we'll say 55 plus 140, that gets you to 195 years old at least for Job. What's interesting is that the average lifespan of man in post-Babel dispersion, before we get to the time of Abraham, is almost 200 years. So Job fits, his lifespan fits right in that window of time when most people were living about 200 years. Now, hopefully you've read the book of Job, and what's interesting is that the narrative sandwiches really the bulk of the book between it. There's 2 chapters of narrative in the beginning, and then there's a chapter of narrative at the end, and everything that happens in the middle is a big discussion that Job has with his friends and ultimately with God. The narrative goes something like this: Job is a wealthy and righteous man considered worthy by God, who's accused by Satan and tested 2 times. The first time he's tested with the loss of all of his wealth and all of his children. And when he doesn't turn on God and curse him, he's tested a 2nd time, and this time his health is affected. He's struck with boils from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet, and even his wife stops supporting him in his allegiance to God. Curse God and die, she says. I can't think of a more disheartening thing to know that the one person who's supposed to stand with you through thick and thin is just telling you to give up. And through all this, Job doesn't sin. And he's visited by 3 friends who come to console him in his misery: Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, and at some point, a younger acquaintance anyway, Elihu the Buzzite, comes and joins the group. But at least the 3 friends sit with Job for 7 days in silence, saying nothing to him. And then beginning in chapter 3, the silence is broken and they enter into a discussion which turns into a debate. Each of them taking turn responding to one another, and ultimately it morphs into a trial of Job. Job begins by questioning God, and he professes his innocence. He's wondering, why and for what reason, God, would you punish me so harshly? Well, in turn, each of his 3 friends respond basically with, obviously God thinks you're a sinner. Otherwise, you wouldn't be experiencing this hardship that you're experiencing. And each time, Job responds, professing his innocence before God. Elihu finally speaks up, and he suggests that sometimes trials aren't a result necessarily of sin, but trials are given as a way to prove character, to be refined, to point man closer to his relationship with God. And when Elihu is done speaking in chapter 38 through 41, God finally speaks to Job. This time, God questions Job, at which point Job realizes, I've spoken out of turn. I should not have been questioning your plan, God, or your purpose for me. And when he repents, he is restored and receives back a double portion of everything that was taken away from him. Now, the lesson of the account of Job for Israel initially, and even for God's people down through the ages, I think is simple. We need to recognize that not all suffering is punishment for sin. And that sometimes the righteous suffer sometimes alongside the wicked, and sometimes when it seems the wicked aren't suffering. And yet throughout all of those experiences, God is sovereign. And God has a bigger plan than what we could imagine in our own mind. And so we need to trust Him. But then this brings us back to the narrative in Genesis. And the next major character that we talk about is Abraham. And from 2091 to 2029, it covers a period of roughly 62 years, from chapters 12 through 23. Chapter 12 begins when Abram is 75 years old, and God calls him and makes a promise to him that he would receive a land and have many descendants, and that through his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. And Abraham responds faithfully by going out from his home country and settling in the land of Canaan in 2091 BC. In chapters 12 through 14, we're related some things about famine in the land and sojourning down in Egypt, where Abram lies about Sarah. You know, that's, yes, she's my wife, but really she's my sister. Tell people that you're my sister so they don't kill me. So there's that experience. In chapter 13, we have the separation of Abram from his nephew Lot, who had come with them. In chapter 14, we read about the wars of the kings and the rescue of Lot and Abram meeting Melchizedek, priest of God Most High. Another illustration that not just the descendants of Abraham knew about the one true God. In chapters 15 through 21, we're told about the covenant promises being renewed and that Abraham is promised that he himself will have a son even in his old age. Chapter 16, we have the birth of Ishmael through Hagar when Abraham is about 86 years old. In chapter 17, we have the sign of the covenant circumcision being given to Abraham when he's 99 years old. In chapter 18 is the birth of Isaac promised. Chapter 19, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the account of the debasement of Abraham's nephew Lot. In chapter 20, we have another time where Abram lies about the identity of his wife Sarah, but God preserves her. And ultimately in chapter 21, Isaac is born to Abraham and Sarah when Abram is 100 years old. In Genesis chapter 22, we have the testing of Abraham. I would suggest to you this is probably when Isaac is a teenager, at least. God calls upon Abram and says, that son that you love, that son of promise, I want you to offer him as a burnt offering to me. And Abram's about ready to go through with it, but God stops his hand and renews the covenant promises that God made with him. In chapter 23, we read about the death of Sarah, who lived to the age of 127 years old, which means she died when Abraham was 137 years old. And the account of Abram buying the cave in the field of Machpelah as a burial place for his family, which, by the way, is the only property that Abraham ever owned in the Promised Land in his lifetime. And then we transition over from Abraham to the account of his son Isaac in Genesis chapter 24 through 26. And even though this is less chapters, it covers more years. Roughly 97 years of history are covered in these three chapters. Chapter 24 is the account of Isaac's bride being brought from back home. It's actually his first cousin once removed, Rebekah, and is comforted at the loss of his mother. And that happened when Isaac was 40 years old. He would have been about 37 when his mother died, and 40 when he marries Rebekah. In chapter 25, this is the first place in the Genesis account, by the way, that the chronology is demonstrably out of order. Okay? Chapter 25 begins with the account of the death of Abraham. But we know that Jacob and Esau, which is later on in chapter 25, that their birth occurred when Isaac was 60 years old, making Abram 160. Abraham's not going to die until he's 175 years old, the text tells us. In chapter 25, we have the account of Esau selling his birthright to his brother Jacob. And presumably that occurs prior to his 40th birthday, or sometime before 1966 BC. And then in Genesis chapter 26, we're related some of Isaac's dealings in the land of Canaan over a 35-year period. He settles here, he settles there, he increases greatly, he plants seed, he has a good harvest, he makes covenants with people, he argues over wells, basically the life of Isaac in a nutshell. And that brings us then to the story of Isaac's son of promise, which is Jacob, through whom the line of the seed will be traced. And in Genesis chapter 27 through 36 is Jacob's account, covering, again, a short period of time, only about 31 years of history. In chapter 27, Jacob steals the blessing from his older brother Esau through his deception and lying to his father. And what's interesting is a lot of times we think about this event happening when Jacob and Esau were relatively young men, maybe even teenagers, because Jacob's just following the instruction of his mother Rebekah, doing whatever she tells him to do, as a good little boy would. What's interesting is through some deductive reasoning and math, we can be very confident that the twins, Jacob and Esau, were actually 77 years old when Jacob steals the blessing from his brother. Not a young boy, a grown man. That means that Isaac, interestingly enough, would have been 137 years old when he blesses his sons, which makes sense because his half-brother Ishmael lived to be 137 years old, and he died. And so here's Isaac thinking, well, my older brother died at 137. I'm creeping up on my 137th birthday. I better take care of my estate before I pass away. Of course, Isaac's going to live several more decades after this. But that seems to be the rationale for why he blesses at this time. In Genesis chapter 28, we have a 77-year-old Jacob fleeing from his home to Haran, his mother's country, for safety from his angry brother Esau. And there on the way at Bethel, he encounters in a dream the ladder going to heaven, and makes a promise to serve God all the days of his life. In chapters 29 through 30, we have Jacob working for his uncle Laban for a period of 20 years. 7 years he works and is able to marry his one cousin, Leah, at which point, because he really wanted to marry Rachel, he's allowed to marry both of them, but he has to work another 7 years to earn Rachel. But it's during that second 7 years of labor that 11 sons and one daughter are born to Jacob. And then he works an additional 6 years for his father-in-law, Laban, to earn his flocks and herds. And so at the age of 97, Jacob and his family then return to Canaan. They're pursued by Laban. Jacob wrestles with God at the Jabbok. He appeases the assumed wrath of Esau by sending ahead of him his generous, bountiful gift, and ultimately settles outside of Shechem. And there in Shechem, his daughter Dinah is raped by one of the inhabitants of the city. And his sons make a bargain with the men of the city that we'll intermarry with you as long as you all circumcise yourselves like we are. But they weren't being honest. Because in the third day, after the men had circumcised themselves, when they were incapacitated, Levi and Simeon went throughout the city and slaughtered every male of the city of Shechem. And I would suggest to you that it happened probably around the time that Simeon was 21 years old and Levi was 20 years old. And so then Genesis chapter 35 through 36 has some accounts of Jacob moving around within the land of Canaan, a renewing of the covenant at Bethel, the birth of Benjamin, and the death of Rachel at the same time. In chapter 35, there's an incident about Reuben and Jacob's concubine Bilhah in chapter 35 and verse 22. And then we're told about the death of Isaac at the end of chapter 35. Chapter 36 is really all about Esau and his descendants. What's interesting to me is that this is the second place in the narrative where it's not following a strictly chronological order. Because Isaac, who dies at the end of chapter 35 at the age of 175 years old, isn't actually going to die until Joseph has been down in Egypt for at least 12 years. So, that's interesting. Isaac was around when his grandson Joseph was sold into slavery. Sometimes those are things that we don't think about. And there's also in my mind a little bit of a question about when exactly Benjamin was born. I don't know. It's possible at the reading of the text that Benjamin was born prior to Joseph being sold down into Egypt. But it's also possible that Benjamin and Rachel, his mother, didn't die until after Joseph had been sold down into slavery in Egypt. But that brings us to the last major character and section of the study of Genesis. And it covers about 93 years from Joseph going down into Egypt until his death in 1805 BC. In chapter 37, we learn about the fact that Joseph is loved by his father. but hated by his brothers because of the favoritism. His brothers try to kill him, but then decide, wait, let's not kill him, let's sell him into slavery. And so he's taken down into Egypt as a slave. He's bought by Potiphar, and ultimately some things are going to happen well with him. But we have interspersed here in chapter 38 an account of Judah and his family. And some things that happen with his descendants, and specifically his daughter-in-law Tamar, whom he gets pregnant and by whom he has two twin sons. And the reason why that's relevant and important is because you might think, reading the narrative, that the story of the line of the seed goes through Joseph, the favored son of Jacob. But that's not what God chose. Jesus, the seed, will ultimately come through the line of Judah, through whom all the kings of Israel, or at least the southern kingdom of Judah, will come in the house of David. But coming back to the story of Joseph in Genesis chapter 39, it is really a roller coaster ride for Joseph down in Egypt over the course of the next 13 years. He becomes great in Potiphar's house. Potiphar's wife lies about him. He's thrown into jail, where he then rises to prominence again. At the age of 28, he interprets the dreams of Pharaoh's officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and then is forgotten about for two whole years. Until at the age of 30, he is recalled from prison to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. Dreams that would indicate there's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. And so Joseph says, this is what you need to do to prepare for it. And again, Joseph is promoted to this high position within Egypt, second in command under only Pharaoh himself. And in chapters 42 through 48, we read how over the first 2 years of the famine, Joseph's brothers travel multiple times down to Egypt to buy grain, throughout which Joseph orchestrates circumstances to be able to reveal to them his true identity and to bring his whole family down to Egypt, where they will settle in the land of Goshen in about 1876 BC. Chapters 49 and 50 cover the last days of Jacob, the blessing of his sons and his grandsons, and then his death at age 147. And he made his sons promise, when I die, don't bury me in Egypt, take me back to the land of our fathers and bury me in the cave in the field of Machpelah, where my father, grandfather Abraham is buried, where Sarah is buried, where Isaac is buried and Rebekah is buried, and where I buried Leah. Rachel, interestingly enough, is the only one who wasn't buried in the cave of Machpelah. And so they take him back and bury him there. And the book of Genesis closes with the record of the account of the death of Joseph at the age of 110 years old in 1805 BC. And so with that, we've covered 2,369 years of biblical history. And we've seen from the creation and the fall of man and the gradual unfolding of God's eternal plan for redemption, which would ultimately be realized through the seed that would come from the line of Abraham, Jesus Christ. And we've traced the line of that seed from Adam down to the calling of the man, Abraham, the formation of his family through his promised son, Isaac, and his promised son, Jacob, who gained the birthright and the blessing from Esau, fulfilling God's predetermined plan. And then Jacob's 12 sons, who became the heads of 12 tribes of Israel. And we've seen the planting of the seeds of a nation, how Israel's family ended up down in Egypt, where they would be able to increase as a unique people who God will later call out to be his own. And so looking ahead, we're going to see how that family of Israel becomes a full-fledged nation, a people special to God, through whom we learn about things like covenant relationship, sin and sacrifice, and the scheme of redemption, and through whom ultimately will come the Christ who will save us from the problem of our sin.